Welcome to Nightlife, the podcast.
Well, yes, first up, to clever design that might minimise the effect of big floods, could it really be possible, using big engineering works and innovative building techniques, to stop the often catastrophic effects of flood, even when the increasingly severe weather events predicted with climate change occur? Professor Elizabeth Mossop, Dean of the UTS School of Design, Architecture and Building, is with us. Elizabeth is a landscape architect and urbanist with wide-ranging experience in both landscape design and urban planning. She's the founding principal of Spackman Mossop and Mossop and Michaels. They're architects with bases both in Australia and New Orleans in the United States. She was in New Orleans at the time of Hurricane Katrina, which sharpened her views on lots of things. She argues it's time for building and infrastructure design relating to water flow to be much smarter. How come we still build houses that still can't cope with big floods on floodplains, even though we know this country produces them, and into the future, perhaps more often? What do you think needs to change to prevent our towns and cities from being devastated by periodic floods? Elizabeth, good evening. Welcome to Nightlife.
Hi there, Philip.
Terrific to have you with us too. You're joining us from Lismore. I mean, this is a community still reeling from the floods in February this year. You're working with the Northern Rivers Reconstruction Group in partnership with UTS and Southern Cross. Tell us how you're all working together and what are you doing?
Well, I have in fact just come from the launch of something called the Living Lab Northern Rivers, which is a collaborative project between these three institutions to try to bring together experts across all of the relevant disciplines to really provide advice and technical expertise both to government but also to the affected communities in the Northern Rivers region to try to bring the best science, the best engineering, the best design to helping this region to build back better.
Yeah. See, there'll be plenty of people hearing this would say, hang on, yeah, okay, Elizabeth, we've had floods in Australia since white people have been here, and presumably they were there before that as well. We've never dealt with them particularly well. We don't seem to have learned anything. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think you're right. Because one of the things is that we have very short memories. And so that.
And we never think it's going to happen again, do we?
Don't think it's going to happen again. And everybody's instinct when one of these disasters strikes is to try to move on, to get over it, to rebuild,
yeah,
and to get on with life. And people do not want to be sort of wallowing in the disaster and constantly revisiting it. And I guess for a whole variety of reasons, psychologically, we do want it to just be an aberration and it's not going to happen again. Mm. But we are now, you know, it's so obvious that we are at the absolute pointy end of the climate crisis, and we have really got to be thinking about these kinds of events as much more part of business as usual. And so we've got to really be able to work in an adaptive way in the long term to try to build these things into our thinking about what, yeah, our towns and cities are going to be like.
I want to drill down into that in a minute about what that actually in practical terms means, because it's even when you start talking about it, you think this is a massive task. But I wanted to ask you first about your experiences in New Orleans. Now, you lived through Hurricane Katrina. Now, this was a Category 5 Atlantic hurricane that caused over 1,800 deaths, killed 1,800 people, and they say the damage bill was something like $125 billion in damage. It eclipsed what we've had here in Australia. The most disadvantaged people, of course, suffered the most. Tell us what you witnessed there and why it changed your thinking about these things.
Well, it was a huge natural event. And, you know, one of the things I witnessed was the absolute dysfunction of all levels of government.
Yeah.
And that was absolutely, that in many ways was more terrifying than the actual storm itself. And I think, like many of these disasters, what happened was that it just uncovered a whole lot of things that already existed. As you mentioned, one of the things particularly that happens with floods, it's often true for natural disasters, but particularly storms and floods always affect most disadvantaged people the most.
Of course. You know, they're the poorest, they don't have insurance, they don't have resources to rebuild.
And they all live at the lowest elevations and in the most floodplain and fragile places.
Yeah.
And what happened in New Orleans was the floodwaters sat there for 6 weeks, and there was very little sort of government activity in terms of rescue and recovery. People, many communities, I think, were really abandoned to just deal with these things themselves. And, you know, I grew up in Australia, and, you know, I knew we had bushfires, but I had no personal direct experience of any kind of natural disaster on this.
Of a big flood on this scale. I mean, I remember reading at the time thinking, and there were a lot of people saying, this is it for New Orleans. It, you know, it's always been flood prone anyway, and this is it. We cannot rebuild this city, and we're going to have to build it somewhere else. And, you know, this is it. New Orleans is over. That didn't happen. They did rebuild New Orleans on the same place, didn't they?
They did, and a few years later, we had Superstorm Sandy, which did a version of the same sort of thing to New York, and no one said, gee, we're not going to rebuild New York. So I think that a lot of those sorts of reactions are really about cultural attitudes to different kinds of places. I mean, when after Hurricane Katrina, you know, there was a lot of chatter and sort of what I thought at the time were conspiracy theories about the fact that the federal government was, you know, they were conspiring not to send resources there. But after a while, I came to think it's not a conspiracy theory, it's actually the truth, because I think that at that point, the government in the US really did not want New Orleans to come back. It was the last major Democrat voting bloc in the South. And I think they were quite happy to see a lot of that population dispersed.
Mm. Which is a political issue, I suppose. But one of the things that occurred to you, though, was that it caused a mindset change to you, because you thought, well, hang on, it's not the disaster here that's the catastrophe. It's not Hurricane Katrina. It's the catastrophic failure of the New Orleans levee system, which caused this devastation. And that, you know, we shouldn't be thinking of moving New Orleans. We should be thinking of ameliorating, improving, flood-proofing the place. Did that happen?
It has happened to quite a considerable extent. There has been massive investment in flood mitigation infrastructure, right, and sort of around the city, and also the rebuilding of its internal levee system that has made the city significantly more resilient to future floods. And we have seen that in hurricanes since, like Hurricane Ida most recently, which hit the city, and it did cause considerable damage, but far less than it would have without a functioning flood protection system.
Mm. So, and this is the nub of what I think you're saying here. You're saying the argument shouldn't be about whether we rebuild Lismore. Of course we're going to do that. And the argument shouldn't be about whether we rebuild Lismore where it is, because we probably should do that too. but it's how we rebuild. Is that it? Is that the nub of what you're saying?
That is at the heart of it. And unfortunately, there aren't any very simple answers. And I think that it is clear that there may be some parts of Lismore that should not be rebuilt. Mm-hmm. We do not want to be putting people into harm's way, you know, in a way that they cannot be protected from future catastrophic events. So, yes, there may be some areas that we need to retreat from.
What about the main street there? Do you think that should be rebuilt or should it be abandoned?
I think that the sort of the heart of downtown Lismore is the place where Lismore's history resides.
Exactly.
It's the identity of the town. I think that there is that downtown Lismore is going to survive. I'm not, you know, I don't think we exactly know in what form or how much of it. I think that a lot of those areas that are close to downtown are very, very low lying. I think that the parts of downtown that survive, we are going to be designing those very differently, you know, and I think we may be over time, we might see change in land use. We might see more, for example, we might see more recreational and cultural activities in the downtown that can be more resilient to future flooding. But I think that it's going to survive as an important part of future Lismore.
Mm. I was watching ABC television earlier tonight about, in fact, coincidentally, the main street of Lismore, which sparked this conversation. And the reporter was talking to a baker who'd rebuilt the bakery that had been completely devastated above the ceiling by the floods. He wasn't waiting, in a sense, for the government. He'd rebuilt it on the same site, in the same property, and was rebuilding it with all sorts of different, he hoped, flood-proof materials. Steel, you know, steel joists, steel roof and wall members, metal cladding rather than gyprock and so on. Absolutely no floor coverings. No, we get rid of carpet or any floor coverings at all. Use concrete and put everything in there, the equipment. Everything is on wheels so that it can just simply be wheeled out. Is that the sort of thing we're talking about?
Yes. And I think that, you know, a lot of those retailers and businesses in downtown Lismore, they've done this before. They're going to do it again. You know, they understand that periodically these floods are going to come through.
Of course they are, yeah.
I think this is the sort of adaptation that we have to think about, is that what are these uses where they can be agile to some extent. You know, we used to be sort of resigned to the fact that the ground floor was going to flood. This time around, you know, we've seen the first and second floor flood. But, you know, there are ways to construct buildings so that they're much more robust to the impact of water, and that the fixtures and fittings, just like the bakery, can be wheeled in, can be wheeled out, can be taken out and, you know, stored at higher ground when these flood events happen, and then can be brought back in and be operating again relatively quickly.
Hmm. But that doesn't really help things like, I don't know, petrol stations, which can't do that. I mean, there's lots of infrastructure which can't just be put on wheels, can it? I mean, when it gets flooded, it gets ruined.
Exactly.
There's a whole lot of plumbing systems, for example, the same. When they get flooded, they get ruined and have to be replaced.
Yeah, and so, you know, you've got to think very carefully about what, you know, what's going to go where in future, and are there ways, you know, that, you know, where the infrastructure, where the machinery, those kinds of things can be on upper levels, Or if that is not possible, for example, like with storage tanks or things like that that are going to be underground, yeah. Well, maybe those uses are the kinds of things that are going to have to be relocated.
They're going to be relocated elsewhere. So you could still have retail. You could still have retail in the main street, provided it was of this nimble kind you're talking about.
Yes, and the thing is, there are other uses. There are sort of educational uses and cultural uses and things like that. That you know where the activity is really about people, you know, rather than a whole lot of machinery and fixtures and fittings that are going to be destroyed by flooding. You know, the cost of this kind of adaptation is very, very significant. There's no question about it. However, the cost is much less than what it takes to repair things after a flood and to try to make things good. And you know, all of that does not even really account for the damage that is caused to people and the disruption to their lives if we are not building this kind of thinking in and if we are not really doing the adaptation.
Can we talk about hard surfaces and slow rain? I mean, I want to go back to buildings in a moment because there's a lot to talk about in buildings, I know. One of the great devastations of floods is it just kills and washes away roads. And road building's laborious and expensive, and it's, you know, it's slow to redo as well. You talk about slow rain and fast rain. Tell us about that.
Well, one of the ways that we make flooding more acute is because we have paved over everything in these catchment areas. Mm-hmm. The more hard surfaces you have, the more quickly the rain runs off and the more you have to have sort of stormwater systems to try to take the water away. You know, our goal should always be for water to be reabsorbed into the ground where it falls or as close to that as possible. So the more we can have soft surfaces, the more we can have what is called green infrastructure that helps us to infiltrate water back into the ground and back into the natural hydrological cycle, the more robust places can be.
But people in the Central West would say, yeah, that's exactly what we had. I mean, you wouldn't find a whole lot of paved areas in Yugara and places like this. You know, the flooding, those floodplains, which when the rivers flood, the Lachlan floods, for example, just the water spreads everywhere. The land becomes so soaked that it can't absorb.
No, and that's obviously that has been the problem all over New South Wales this year. Is we have had everywhere there has been so much rain that all of those natural systems are basically full. There has been absolutely no way for the water to go. Mm. You know, we are completely, you know, we have not adjusted our systems and our way of thinking about this to really deal with this increased intensity and increased frequency of storms and of flooding. You know, we are relying on an old paradigm for these kinds of things, which is no longer serving us. And, you know, so that we've got to become much more responsive and much more nimble in terms of how we think about flooding and how we think about modelling flooding for the future.
Mm. So what, I mean, thinking about this, because, I mean, here we have in Lismore a chance to do something because this is a city that's flooded regularly over the course of its history. I mean, it was originally placed where it is because the river was the main means of transport, and that's why it's there. If you were thinking as of a greenfield site today, you wouldn't put it there. You'd put it somewhere else because you would say it's too likely to flood here. But however, it is where it is, and as you say, there's a strong community push, and that should happen to rebuild the city. And it's to preserve its heritage and all of those things. So what do we rebuild? In a practical sense, what do you say we rebuild and how do we rebuild? What sort of things do we rebuild? People are texting me saying, does that mean everything's on stilts? Because the stilts really wouldn't save you, would they?
Well, I think that there are some areas where elevating buildings like that is going to make a huge difference. If your future flooding is going to be less than one story, yes, build everything like Queenslanders. Put them up, you know, one level into the air. You get yourself this useful, lovely, cool, shaded area under the building or under your house for various different things, and that will make some areas more robust. So elevation is a possibility. There are probably areas where you do not want residential uses in the future. So those people need buyouts or land swaps or some way to give them a viable alternative so that they can go and live somewhere else. And there may also be businesses that are in that category as well. And then there are areas where, you know, perhaps we are going to contemplate that they will quite regularly be flooded to some relatively minor extent. And then we have to think about, well, what are the things we can do to adapt these buildings and adapt these uses to make them more resilient to that water? And that's the sort of thing you were talking about before, like thinking about materials that won't be damaged by water, you know, designing buildings so that it's relatively easy for floodwaters to pass through them, you know, so that they're not held up by internal dams and things like that.
1300 800 222. I'm talking with Professor Elizabeth Mossop from the UTS School of Design, Architecture and Building. Elizabeth is involved quite closely with communities and experts in Lismore, talking about what's going to happen there. She's Dean of the UTS School of Design, Architecture and Building and has worked in New Orleans as it recovered from Hurricane Katrina. As I say, currently working on flood reconstruction in and around Lismore. If you've got questions or comments, love to hear from you. If you'd love to join this conversation, 1300 800 222, text 0467 922 702. What do you think we should do? Do we build on floodplains? Should we be raising more dam walls? And should we be diverting water runoff courses to include more slow rain features that we were talking about? Elizabeth, what do you think about, just in terms of building design, so what do those things mean? We've talked a bit about the baker who's, you know, used concrete and steel. Talk to me a bit about that. What's a flood-resistant house look like, or a flood-resistant commercial building look like?
I think materials like concrete and steel and some of these other industrial materials are very robust to flooding. And the sort of historical materials that we see, for example, in some of the older buildings around Lismore, you know, that were built for beautiful old cedar and have pressed metal and those kinds of materials, those are very robust to flooding. Our 20th century materials, composite materials, you know, are, you know, obviously things like carpets and anything soft, those are, you know, just a disaster in flooding. Yeah. So I think if we look at some of those historical materials, if we look at industrial materials, and we think about things like, you know, where you've got cabinetry and those kinds of things, ways for those to be removable or relocatable so that they can come out and not be damaged.
But how practical is that really? I mean, I was thinking of the baker again. I was thinking, well, fine, if the baker's got a truck that he, when you know, because when a flood is on, it's not as though you're the only person affected here. Everyone's affected. Everyone's seen the water coming. I mean, you know, there simply aren't flat-top trucks around to assist you. So you've got to, you'd have to be on your own here. And when you start thinking about the logistics of all of that and moving removable, you know, cabinetry and equipment and workbenches and all of that from, you can see almost immediately that it's not going to be very practical, is it?
I think that if you design and build these things in and figure it out in advance, these sorts of things are doable. You know, in my house in New Orleans, we had a double height space. And so it was possible to move things through that space from the ground floor into the upper floor of the house.
Right.
Yes, of course, it's a horrifying nuisance, but again, way less of a nuisance than having to start again or lose all of those things and rebuild. So that it is about the sort of, you've got to calibrate what the nuisance level and what is and is not possible, and also to give people the tools so that they can be reasonably self-sufficient in these kinds of things, as you say, because everybody is going to be doing this.
You'd be on your own when the flood's on, because you'd have to deal with it yourself. They're simply, I mean, it would be beyond the capacity of any authority, government or otherwise, to assist everybody at once, if this was the case. James is on the line. Hi, James. If you'd like to join the conversation, 1-300-800-222. James, you're in Lismore, are you?
I am, yes.
Yeah, hi.
Good evening. How are you?
Good evening. Yes, no, very well. Tell me your thoughts.
Well, my wife and I, in our home on the 28th of February, encountered just over 30 feet of water moving at over 80 kilometres an hour.
Mm.
Now, the floor of our home is 15 feet above the ground, and we wound up on the roof of our home, and we're still living in a house that's got no internal walls, one power point, no kitchen, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm just wondering, what do we look at doing with our home? I mean, what are we going to do? Put it on 40-foot high stilts? And then how do we get furniture up into it?
How do you live in a house like that?
How do you live in a house like that? Yeah. It becomes impractical.
Yeah, I know. And I was thinking, look, I'm glad you raised it, because I was thinking of the baker tonight, and I was thinking, look, this solution may well work for the baker, but you can see if it's applied across everybody, it's simply not going to work. It's simply not going to work.
Well,
Elizabeth, go on, James.
The baker after 2017 put all of his baking equipment up into a mezzanine height level, which he believed would be beyond flooding. And, of course, this flood has proven that to be
wrong. Yeah.
I think the options for Lismore are many and varied and pretty interesting when you sit back and look at them and start thinking about them.
Mm. What do you want to do?
Personally? Look, Lismore's been settled for 197 years.
Yeah.
In that time, it's had 180 floods.
Mm.
So if I was a racing car driver and I came to you and said, look, I'm going to have a really good season next year. I want you to invest money in me. I want $5 million. I'm going to buy myself a new car, two spare motors, and a really good pit crew. You'd say, well, how many races have you been in? I'd say 197. You go, that's pretty good. How many have you crashed in? 180? That's where the conversation would end.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I honestly have a leaning towards thinking it's time we look at relocating
the whole town. Yep. Well, not the whole town, but good slabs of it.
Yeah, absolutely.
Including the main street and the downtown business area.
Correct. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. I mean, people keep saying to me, "Oh, look, just fix your house up. Wait a couple of years. People will forget about the flooding. Sell it and get other people into it." And I don't want to do that. I don't want to put anybody. I don't want anybody to face what we went through. Period.
Yep. What do you say about that, Elizabeth? I mean, James has got a point here, isn't he? I mean, he can't. He's already a floor higher than he needs to be. I mean, he can't go any higher.
Exactly. And I mean, it is completely impractical to think about, you know, elevating houses higher and higher and higher and higher. I mean, there's, apart from anything, there's no way to get in and out of them. That's right. Practical. Elevated houses have all sorts of access challenges for people, you know, who have mobility issues. There's no question that there are some areas where we should not be locating, particularly residential development, because, as James says, we do not want anybody to have that kind of experience again. And yes, we can do a better job of predicting what's going to happen in terms of flooding. We can probably do a better job of mitigating flooding, but we do have to make very hard decisions about some of these places where the risk is just too great and where it does not make sense to be continuing to invest and to be putting people in harm's way in the same way. And obviously, you know, and there are a significant number of people in Lismore, like James, who have had these absolutely horrendous and terrifying experiences.
James, yeah. if you were offered, I don't know whether you will be, but if you were offered to buy it, would you take it?
Oh, I'd certainly look at it. Look, in the perfect world, I'd be able to relocate my house to higher ground.
Yeah.
We love our house. It's a very old house. It was actually moved to the address it's at when they built the Lismore shopping square. It was originally on site up where the square now is. Yeah. But I have no desire. I would not leave this house and put. People have said, "Oh, why don't you put students in there? Why don't you rent it out?" I don't want people to be in the path of what we went through.
Yeah.
And I don't want to be responsible for that.
You would like, if you could, to pick the house up and put it somewhere out of harm's way.
Correct.
Is that going to be an option, do you think?
I have no idea. I have no idea what the options are going to look like once they're all put on the table. I think Elizabeth raised an interesting point when she spoke about, you know, we can't continue to expect governments to invest and invest and invest, particularly in locales such as Lismore with such a long history of flooding.
That's right.
You know, why would a government keep investing large sums of money in a town which continues to build in the way of harm?
Yeah. Thanks, James. I think it's a powerful point, Elizabeth, isn't it? Because much as I understand, and I'm not making a harsh comment here, and I haven't lived through it either, but I understand people's, you know, enthusiasm, their resilience and strength and desire to rebuild communities. I understand that completely. But is there a point here at which we say, well, look, we are going to rebuild this community, but it can't be here?
Well, I think we are going to rebuild this community, but it's not going to be exactly the same as it used to be.
But you're saying in Lismore it is going to be where it is.
Well, I think some of it is going to be where it is and some of it is going to move. I don't think that there's a particularly straightforward answer to any of this. I think there is no doubt that there are some places in Lismore that we need to retreat from because the sorts of experience that James had is going to be repeated in the future, and that really is not tenable. So I do think, and I do think that this is a moment for many of these communities, a moment of real change and transition.
Yeah. I wonder though, I suppose this is a hard question and there's no easy answer to it, but I wonder who's actually, I know you're thinking about it, but I wonder who's actually managing this, because you get the sense that people are going ahead and doing their own thing. I mean, they're rebuilding, they're cleaning the place out and starting again, putting new furniture in and getting the place ship shape again, which I fully understand. What should be happening? I mean, should, because this is a huge question, isn't it? Is there somebody who should be saying, well, we're not going to allow you to do that?
Well, certainly sort of in Lismore and in the Northern Rivers, we've got the Northern Rivers Reconstruction Corporation, which is starting to roll out its housing package for residents who are going to be offered a range of alternatives to for buyouts, for house elevations, and also, I believe, for floodproofing. Now, I am not across the detail of this, and I believe it is going to be offered to residents on a sort of a case-by-case basis, you know, rather than the sort of the production of maps or zones. So I don't understand yet exactly how this is going to work. And I know that They have learned a lot from the work that has been done in Brisbane. And I must say, you know, it's terrific that there is a government agency that is genuinely engaging with this. It is, you know, there's no doubt that the residents of, you know, there are so many people in Lismore who are still without adequate housing and who are still, you know, they do not yet have sustainable options for decent shelter. And I think, you know, that is terribly difficult 8 months
of course on. And that's a hugely powerful issue, and I understand, and it's an, in a sense, almost a separate issue, isn't it, because we're dealing with the human tragedy of this, and we're trying to also talk about what's a way forward too. Kim's on the road. Hi, Kim.
Hi, how are you?
Not bad.
Good. Now I travel along the M1 here and up to Queensland for pleasure. Anyway, I stopped on the way through, on the way along, so I'll pull into Kempsey, but I had to detour off the road, and Kempsey used to be the main way up to Queensland along the Pacific Highway.
Yep.
Well, it's a ghost town now, because there's not much commerce coming through. Now, I understand that Lismore was basically built on the same basis, that, you know, it was to do with commerce, that boats come through as you, very much so,
because the river, that's right, the river was the main source of transport.
But if you even look at ancient history, like the city of Petra, somewhere in the Middle East somewhere, now that used to be a main commercial hub, but it's basically just a stone monument all over the place, because commerce changed. So really, in my view, and it's just my view, you've got to move or perish. You know, you have to relocate yourself somewhere. You'll obviously do with commerce. Otherwise, the reason why Lismore exists is because there's enough commercial activity there for it to be a township. But, you know, and of course, the butcher had built himself up there. Well, there's the risk versus reward situation there for him. He says it's worth the risk for him to build where he is because he likes the location. But then there's others, right? Now, if you're going to build or live in there, I mean, you might have to. You know, the professor in architecture, Elizabeth Lady, maybe it's a good opportunity to think outside the square. Half the town that can't be built on anymore, turning to lovely sort of parklands or woodlands, the other areas will become urban. I mean, it's to do with the circumstances that exist at the time. So, my view is that, yeah, this will probably exist, but not in the same way as it wants to. And that's my view on it. So move or perish, that's my view.
Thanks, Kim. That's in part what you're saying, I think, isn't it, Elizabeth? One of my texters says in Christchurch, New Zealand, there were parts designated as not to be built on again. Can we talk about floodplains for a bit? This is a huge issue because when we're talking about Australian floodplains, we're not talking about small areas. We're talking about massive areas. And it's not simple to say you can't build on floodplains, is it? Because where are people going to live?
Well, I do think there is a clue in the name, and that we should be avoiding floodplain development to the greatest extent that we can. And I think that that is something that we have not given enough attention to in recent years. And I do think that very, very often there are much better alternatives to floodplain development. We can look at increased density and a whole range of other strategies to stay out of harm's
way. I mean, for example, in the central west of New South Wales, what would you do about development there, which historically, again, has been built on rivers for reasons of transport? And yet, as we've discovered, these are places that are just inherently flood prone because they are built on floodplains. Because when rivers flood, that's where the towns are too. I mean, are we seriously suggesting that all of these towns need to be moved?
Well, I don't know that we are necessarily suggesting that. Conditions have changed. We have developed these catchments, and we are now dealing with a very different kind of climate regime, so that we have to have a very, very hard look at what the risks actually are. And it may well mean over time that we do retreat from some of these areas, or we do the kinds of engineering and river channel work that is going to divert those floodwaters into different locations. Because the thing is that when floods happen, you know, the water is going to go somewhere, and the question is whether it is going to be in people's living rooms, you know, or whether it, you know, or whether we can find other places for that water to go. You know, and there are a lot of examples of engineering and design works to river channels that modify the way that they operate. But yes, we do have to contemplate, you know, very significant intervention and change in some of these towns and around some of these river systems.
You have looked at also how the Dutch handle low-lying areas, in particular the city of Rotterdam. I mean, the Netherlands or Holland is a very low-lying place. What can we learn from what they've done?
You know, the Netherlands is below sea level, and so the Dutch have a very, very particular focus on water management and water engineering, and they are not afraid of sort of intervening to change these kinds of systems. They used to, you know, work very much to make certain that they were keeping water out of everything. But again, as their delta areas in particular became more developed, they realized that they had to find a way to live with the water, that the flood water was going to come in, and that they had to find a way to accommodate the water. So the flood water had somewhere to go that was not going to be destroying their towns and cities, which are very low-lying. And so that really is these strategies about finding ways to divert floodwaters away from developed areas, but also accommodating those waters within towns and cities in ways that don't damage people's properties, so that storing water in open space and designing public space areas so that when there are rains and storms, they fill up with water and then, you know, the water drains away over time. And so those spaces can come back into use, so that there's a sort of a very different relationship with these floodwaters. We, you know, they come in and then they go away, but without causing damage.
1-300-800-222. Donald's on the line from Perth. Hi, Donald.
Hi there. Here's a suggestion. Why not build the house with the lower floor like a houseboat and on stilts, and have the houseboat attached to the stilts, and then four or six chains around the houseboat, and then as the water rises, the houseboat style house rises, but it's held in place with chains. The chains could be designed to gradually unwind, but it would have to be a more robust base than an ordinary riverboat houseboat. You'd have
sure
to
would
it.
Sure would. If you look at the power, if you look at the power of the water in those, some of those floods, that's, as James was saying, Donald, I mean, you talk about water flowing at 80-90 kilometres an hour. You know, it's,
well, that's what I'm saying. You'd have to build the base, and not like a river houseboat, but to cope with that sort of situation.
Yeah, thank
Anyhow,
you.
If people insist on building on floodplains, they need to do something like that. Otherwise, just don't build on floodplain.
Yep. Okay. Thank you, Donald. And this, these sorts of remarks, don't build on floodplains, Elizabeth, is all very well, but we have. And there are huge numbers of people who live on floodplains.
Yes.
And it's not, and it's simply, I don't know, in my reading of it, it's just not practical to say all those people are going to move somewhere else, is it?
No, no, it's not practical. I do think going forward, we've got to make different decisions about these kinds of things. But obviously, we've got a massive challenge in terms of adaptation for these areas where we do have people in areas that are going to be flooding. And so we've got to think very carefully about what happens in terms, you know, when disasters happen, what happens in terms of evacuation and how do we manage these kinds of things, and what else can we do to try to mitigate and reduce the impact of future floods. And so, again, it might be to do with river engineering or it might be to do with changes that we make to people's neighbourhoods and people's houses.
Yeah, they're even when you start saying things like this, it's massive, isn't it? Who's responsible here? Is it what we saw and what we're seeing a bit in Lismore that people are doing it, you know, taking things into their own hands and doing it themselves? I mean, who in the end needs to be responsible for this? It's easy for people to say, oh, well, the federal government should be doing, you know, should be fixing it. They can't, can they?
Well, it's going to have to be everybody. There is no question that there is a role for government, but, you know, it is simply not possible, as you say, for government to take responsibility for everything. And so people, you know, in many instances, people are taking control, taking things into their own hands and doing what they can. People are, you know, not waiting for government to come to the party because they want to be able to move on with their lives. But it really is, I think this is going to take a really powerful collaboration between communities, between the various levels of government. We've got to have the part, you know, effective participation of the insurance industry. These are the people that really understand how risk works. And I think everybody is going to have to bring their best game to this.
1300 800 222 is the number. John from Brigalong. G'day, John.
Hi. I think we should use the KISS principle. And the KISS principle is the place has been flooded out too many times already. Bulldoze the main street, move it to higher land, and then build a shopping centre, a shopping complex, and then get your rural supplies or your garden supplies and put them in the streets nearby. But put all your shops into one place and have a big car park up there, because you can never get parking in the main street, and move into the 21st century.
Yeah, well, Elizabeth, I mean, because the truth is in Lismore, this has been tried once before, hasn't it? Well, a number of times, actually. The council moved itself and there have been other attempts to move it. People don't follow. That's the thing. How do you make people follow?
Well, you know, there are, you know, you can, government can intervene and try to compel people to do things. I don't think that that is the most appropriate way at this point, in that I think you have to give people reasonable choices. And so I think in this instance, you know, we have to think about, you know, and I think that the Reconstruction Corporation is moving to do this, to provide people with a range of different alternatives. What we found in New Orleans was that even where there were buybacks available, not everybody was prepared to move. There were people who were bound and determined to stay in.
And there will be in Lismore too.
Really unworkable neighbourhoods, right, where they were not going to be able to get any insurance, where they were going to be flooded out again. But I think that, you know, what happened there, well, and will continue to happen there, is that over time, eventually, everybody will move out of those areas. And so, you know, I think it's a matter of putting sensible alternatives, giving people sensible alternatives, and also doing a really good job of showing people what different future Lismores might
look like. Sadly, we have run out of time, but it's not a set of issues we're likely to resolve in one conversation. But I do thank you for your time, Elizabeth. It's been most interesting. Thank you.
Hello, nightlifers. It's Sammy J here. I know you're a bunch of night owls, so you might not be up with early birds like me on ABC Melbourne Breakfast, which is why I wanted to tell you about the Sammy J Snack Pack podcast. I don't want to crow about it, but it's a great little podcast you can soar into, and it's available right now, whatever you're doing. Like, maybe you're flying somewhere, you can listen to it then. Or maybe you're at home doing some nesting, you can listen then. It's also great when you're doing human things as well. That's also an option. The Sammy J Snack Pack. Find it now on the ABC Listen app.